From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the lead-up to the Iraq War and its later conduct, I saw, at a minimum, true dereliction, negligence, and irresponsibility. At worst, lying, incompetence, and corruption. That charge and those words from U.S. Marine Corps General Anthony Zinni, the four-star retired commander-in-chief of U.S. Central Command, who has been laying siege to Bush administration policy in Iraq. Zinni was the Bush administration's top envoy to the Middle East until just before the invasion of Iraq. The 40-year veteran of Vietnam, Somalia, counterterrorism, and top diplomatic duty never bought in. 2 years ago, Zinni said it would be the wrong war at the wrong time. 2 weeks ago, on the CBS News program 60 Minutes, he said staying the course in Iraq would mean heading over Niagara Falls and that it was time for heads to roll at the Pentagon. Zinni's deep experience and blunt broadside attack on the Bush camp has raised speculation that he might himself be a candidate for Secretary of Defense in a Kerry administration. We'll ask him about that tonight and about the rapid-fire chain of events unfolding in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Washington. Anthony Zinni is the first-generation American son of Italian immigrants. He grew up in Philadelphia, served two tours of duty in Vietnam, and went on to a spectacular Marine Corps career. But Vietnam taught him, he says, to speak up when things go wrong. He's out with a new book, co-authored with Tom Clancy, entitled Battle Ready. General Anthony Zinni, good evening, and welcome to On Point.
Good to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you. You've been making a lot of noise in recent weeks. You've never been afraid to speak your mind. Just a couple of weeks ago now, as your new book came out, you were on 60 Minutes talking about American policy in Iraq, the American effort in Iraq, going over Niagara Falls. A lot of things are changing. I wonder how significant you think they are. Is policy there still headed over Niagara Falls?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. Things are changing, and there's going to be a crucial period here over the next few months to see if these changes are going to really signify a major positive shift in what we're what's happening on the ground. I'm encouraged because it was good to see the Iraqis themselves sort of take charge of the process. Obviously, we'll retain our position on the security issues because they're not quite capable of handling that yet. But they're going to start making their own political economic decisions, and they may stumble, but that's the right way to go.
And what about on the security front? As you've watched what's happened in Fallujah and more recently in Karbala, where the Americans have ended up backing off a bit, kind of cutting deals with Iraqis to let them stay in place, maybe lower the profile of their weapons, is this a good strategy or is this retreat and surrender?
Well, first of all, I don't think we should have issued ultimatums about what we were going to do, because then when you do exactly what you said, you back off and you negotiate your way through, it looks like you're weak. We should be careful with these sorts of ultimatums. We have to watch this pretty carefully. If we can successfully negotiate our way through these and it leads to disarmament or the people that have weapons or arms, then becoming reconciled and rejoining a positive course, then it's good. If we're allowing them to get away, reorganize, rearm, but still maintain their adversarial position vis-a-vis us and the Iraqis that want a democracy, then we're going to have a problem down the road, and we're going to have to deal with it directly.
General Zinni, you have been one of the most outspoken high-ranking military men in America for a long time and very prominently in recent weeks. You're not the only general that's spoken out against the war. General Schwarzkopf, General Shinseki raised concerns. Former General Brent Scowcroft raised concerns. But I wonder, given the very high profile of your remarks and your very direct style of speech, what kind of reaction you've had from your military community and beyond, since you went so publicly on the record with your critique of the Iraq war effort. What's it been like?
I never really had any negative reactions from the military community. I don't certainly solicit or seek support. I certainly don't say that I speak for them. I would never do that. I just speak for myself. Some of the reactions outside the community have been personal attacks on me and name-calling. It's unfortunate that those who I disagree with can't defend their positions based on their philosophy or strategy that I think is flawed. But that's the price you pay if you feel a sense of obligation and you speak out. But that doesn't bother me. It's who I am. I don't make these complaints about our strategy and policy and lack of planning very lightly. I think them through. I think it's a part of our obligation as someone who has served in the military to make sure our troops are getting the very best. It's not just a matter of equipment and training. It's a matter of planning and commitment based on solid intelligence. And when you don't see that there, I think you have an obligation to speak up.
Anthony Zinni, you trace your readiness to speak up back as far as Vietnam and maybe farther, but you describe in your book a conversation you had one day there with a Lance Corporal Maui, a big strapping Hawaiian kid, as you describe him, who had been hit in the ankle, a badly damaged leg. It wasn't clear when or how he would recover. Do you remember that day and what you later came to think about your conversation with him and the attitude it would instill in you about how the military ought to talk about American foreign policy?
I do. He asked me why we were there. This was late in the war. It was 1970. And certainly he and the other Marines realized they weren't coming home to confetti parades. And there were a lot of questions about the war. They were tremendously heroic on the battlefield. I had a sense they were doing it for each other and for their unit. But he looked at me. We were both wounded. And he said, why are we here, Captain? And I gave him sort of the pat company answer, and I didn't feel good about that. I really felt that I hadn't answered that, and so the things I was saying were just not panning out on the ground. I didn't see that we were doing the kinds of things to run that war in the right way. There were some bad policy decisions. We were in it on a flawed strategy. I certainly realized the performance of those Marines, soldiers, sailors, airmen that were out there was magnificent, despite all that, but I vowed to myself that from then on, you had to be able to answer that question. You know, if you have men and women committed to possibly giving the ultimate sacrifice for their country, you had better be sure that you can explain to them exactly why they're there. And you better be able to explain it in a letter back to their parents if they're not coming home.
So what about the U.S. military now? They're not all retired, as you are, perhaps not in the same position that you are to speak out. What's your sense of high-level military opinion of what's gone on in Iraq and what's going on there now? They're good soldiers. They're doing what they're told. But what's the attitude? What's the opinion behind the following orders?
Well, you only have two choices when you're in uniform. One is to carry out the order. The other is if you can't agree with it, to leave the service and then speak from the outside. That's what our Constitution provides, and that's what we swear an oath to, that very concept. I don't try to speak. I certainly get a lot of communications from the active duty military, but I would never try to speak for them or to use those communications in any way to back up what I say. Again, what I say is my opinion and my view. There'll be a point in time, and history will tell us what they were thinking, because as they move on in life, there'll be memoirs written and there'll be people that will begin to speak once they're out of uniform, and I'll just leave it for that time.
A lot of news tumbling out in recent days that will affect the Iraq war effort, and more than that, I want to ask you about some of these recent developments. First, the new stop-loss order that will keep more active-duty Army servicemen and women in the Army for longer than they had expected, beyond their anticipated departure date. What does this signify about the force structure of the U.S. military?
Well, it signifies that we don't have sufficient force structure to handle all our commitments, because if you did, then you can readjust the assignment of personnel so you could allow people to move out on their expiration of active service and not destroy the cohesion of a unit. When you have too few units as opposed to the commitments you make, then you can't afford to let them go. In the interest of unit cohesion, you have to deny them the ability to leave or to change duty stations and proceed along the career development path that we would normally find. It adversarially affects morale in many cases, but I certainly believe that somebody like General Schumacher, the chief of staff of the Army, does not make this decision or this request lightly. It's something that you don't do unless you absolutely feel you need it. And it says that we have insufficient structure for our commitments, and you can't maintain this sort of pace of deployment of our units for very long unless you expand the base, meaning the structure.
And when you say structure, you mean the number of men and women in the military?
Well, no, structure, there's two ways you look at this. One is structure. It's the number of battalions, squadrons, and units you have. The other is manning, which is numbers, the numbers that are in there, how long they're in there, so that you have a well-trained, cohesive unit. So you could have each unit manned up fully, but you have too few units. They're rotating too fast. It becomes as destructive to unit cohesion, training, morale, than even if you had enough units, but they were undermanned somewhat. The ideal is that you have sufficient units and they're manned with the numbers of people and qualified skills sufficiently enough that they're certainly capable to carry out their mission.
To sustain that, given the current U.S. foreign policy, strategic policy, does the United States need a larger military?
If we are going to continue these kinds of commitments, this level of requirement for our units overseas and elsewhere in the continental United States, going through training, things like that, then we will need a greater structure, meaning more people, more units.
How much more? How much bigger?
I think to really answer that, we need to do some kind of exhaustive analysis as to where we are in the world, how many of these commitments are viable and should still stand, what others should go away. We have to look at places like Iraq and Afghanistan and make some sort of call about how long this is going to take. And then look at other things like overseas basing, for example. We have units in Europe that are based there. Could we bring them back home and rotate from the United States as a base, a home base? It makes it a lot easier. There's less turmoil and movement of units. There's family stability. So there's many aspects of this that have to be analyzed before you answer a question about how big and what kind of military you should have.
But bottom line, do you think that the United States needs to consider a larger military or to reconsider a policy that requires so big a military?
I think both have to be taken. You can't take it from just one side. You need to look hard at the policy and the requirements for units and where they may be. You need to look at efficiencies and the way you might meet those commitments, size of units, capability, home basing. And then you ought to look at the kind of structure that, honestly, that you can afford, too. I mean, it's a balance of all these things. There's no one way to sort of solve this problem.
General Zinni, you've been outspoken. You've got views on many angles of the military. You've not been afraid to criticize the policies of the Bush administration or the current Pentagon leadership. In fact, you've called for heads to roll there. Are you a candidate for Secretary of Defense in a next presidential administration, be that Bush or Kerry?
No, not at all. I would not want to do that. I would not accept anything like that. I don't want to be considered for anything like that. And I certainly feel they can find more qualified people, but I have no political aspirations, no desire, and will not do that.
Are you sure? You've written 40 years as a Marine, taught me that the only place to be is in the center of the arena. It sure beats sitting in the grandstands criticizing those who have the guts to be out there, and every once in a while you can make a difference. Absolutely no way Anthony Zinni would serve as Secretary of Defense?
No way, and I don't believe the arena is in Washington, D.C. The arena is out there where those young kids are in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. I mean, that's a different story. If the president of my country called on me, much has happened after I retired to be part of the Middle East peace process, you know, to take on a special mission truly in the arena, I would do it. But I want no political position, and I'm not aspiring or lobbying or angling for anything. I want to make that clear.
And why not?
I think if you voice your concern and it looks like or it appears or even that you're accused of seeking some sort of political position or that it's politically motivated, then it taints what you're trying to say. You're suspect. First of all, I personally do not want to do that. I don't find it appealing. But secondly, I feel then it would cloud, as you say, the criticism, which I'm trying to be constructive about, but insist that there is accountability and that we give our people out there the right support that they need. And I don't want that to be clouded by any thoughts about any personal ambitions I have, because basically I have none right now in this area.
You supported George Bush in the year 2000. Who are you supporting in the year 2004 for the presidency?
I don't know. I haven't made that decision yet, and I'm going to have to think about that very carefully.
We're talking tonight with General Anthony Zinni, retired four-star general in the U.S. Marine Corps. He has been a big and outspoken critic of U.S. policy in Iraq. Now, he says, things may be changing there, but there's still a call for accountability. We'll come back and hear the details of that call and what he thinks about what's going on in Iraq and around the world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with General Anthony Zinni, former Commander-in-Chief of United States Central Command. He's out with a new book, Battle Ready, co-written with Tom Clancy, looking at his long 40-year career in the U.S. Marines and a big view of the world out there right now. Anthony Zinni, you have been very critical of the way the United States got into the conflict in Iraq. You opposed it from the beginning back in 2002. You said that the country went in with a faulty plan, a faulty concept, a strategy that's getting troops killed, and you have called for accountability. I wish you'd sit with us on this issue of accountability and get as specific as you can about who should take responsibility for what and with what actions now.
Well, I think the responsibility lies with the civilian leadership at the Pentagon. That's where we expected the kind of strategic thinking, the correct interpretation of intelligence and rationale for the war, the proper planning, especially for the post-Saddam, post-fighting period and the reconstruction period. We wanted an organization on the ground that was prepared and cohesive enough to handle the problems they would run into. We needed the kind of decision-making on the ground that understood the culture, the issues. We didn't get that. I mean, we did get certainly a sterling performance by our young men and women in uniform, but we did not prepare ourselves for the aftermath. We went in there with a rationale that wasn't borne out, with strategic thinking that was flawed, with no real plan on the ground, made mistakes like disbanding the army in Iraq and de-bathifying to a certain point. We created enemies we didn't need to make. We had an organization in the Coalition Provisional Authority that wasn't cohesive or complete enough to really do the political reconstruction, infrastructure reconstruction work that needed to be done. And this is where my criticism is pointed, to that civilian leadership.
Why do you think all that went wrong? That's a big bill of particulars that you're laying down there. What at bottom was pushing in the wrong direction here?
I don't understand. I think that, you know, basically there was some flawed belief that this would be much easier, we would be welcome with open arms, that this would ignite a passion for democracy in the Middle East and change the face of the Middle East. I mean, I heard all these sorts of rationale and arguments. Certainly we did a rush to war. We didn't wait to internationalize this and build a kind of highly credible coalition, much as we did in the first Gulf War. And I don't understand. I think the American people, the president of the United States, the troops that went out there are owed an answer as to why it went down this way.
So who should go? Name names.
Well, you know, the responsibility belongs to the Secretary of Defense and his immediate civilian superiors. They took on this responsibility, and they should be accountable for this in my mind.
Now, Donald Rumsfeld's immediate civilian superiors would be the Vice President Cheney and Dick Cheney?
No, his
and
subordinates. I'm
oh,
sorry.
His subordinates. His
immediate,
excuse me. I see.
Subordinates.
So you're talking there, the Deputy Wolfowitz and right on down.
Well, yeah, those responsible for the planning, those responsible for the strategy, the interpretation of the intelligence, those responsible for the decisions, the association with exile groups that have sadly disappointed us, as you can see in the news now.
Yeah. George Tenet is now gone or going. Why is Donald Rumsfeld still there, in your view?
I don't speak for the president. The president has to make those decisions, and the individuals themselves have to make those decisions. I would say regarding George Tenet, I'm sad to see George go. I have the greatest respect for him, and personally, I like him very much. In my time as the commander of U.S. Central Command, George served me and the others extremely well. He was tireless in his efforts to give us the best support and to constantly ensure that we were satisfied with what we were getting. He's been a great, you know, servant of this country. Unfortunately, this situation and the intelligence now has created his resignation, and I feel badly about that. I think the United States is losing a truly great person that wanted to do the very best for his country.
But if you want to talk about accountability, we all saw what happened with the weapons of mass destruction allegations. They weren't there. Doesn't that land on George Tenet's plate?
I would like to know whether it lands on his plate because the intelligence was wrong and incorrect, or it lands in somebody else's plate because the intelligence as it was given was exaggerated or expanded to be made out to be more imminent and dangerous than it truly was. That question is yet to be answered in my mind. Now, you have to worst case some things. You have to believe that Saddam may still have possessed unaccounted for weapons of mass destruction. But that's different than saying that even if he possessed it, that it was such an imminent threat that you had to rush the war and you couldn't wait for the international process and coalition building much as we did again in the first Gulf War, to form up and take place. So this going of Mr. Tenet may solve our issues regarding responsibility for the intelligence part of this, but I think there's still another question to be answered about the interpretation. George Tenet, in his Georgetown speech, said clearly that the CIA never said the threat was imminent. Well, somebody said it was imminent or implied it strongly. I know, and where's the responsibility for that?
Well, the president implied strongly that it was imminent. Who are you talking about when you talk about people spinning the intelligence, the WMD threat, into such an imminent threat?
Well, I'm talking about whoever presented it to the president in that way. And I don't know who it is, and I wouldn't speculate. But those responsible for doing the analysis and putting it together and interpreting it as grave and gathering or imminent. You know, the president's not an intelligence expert. He uses intelligence. He needs and requires information and interpretation of information to make strategic decisions. He doesn't sit around and do the analysis. And I expect that through these inquiries, investigations, and later on, I would hope people that decide to tell the story that we're in the inside, we come to understand who presented this in such a way that our president made this decision.
Does this come back to the Pentagon civilian top tier? Is that what you're suggesting?
It could very well come back to the civilian top tier of the Pentagon, because certainly they were in the process of creating their own intelligence capability, interpreting it differently, vetting sources like Mr. Shalaby and the exiles that were not acceptable to other intel agencies. But again, that all needs to be sorted out. The American people need an answer to that.
You have spent a lot of time in and interpreting the Middle East. Help us then with a couple of these things. First, Ahmed Chalabi. Now, he is alleged by U.S. authorities to have tipped the Iranians off that Washington had broken their top intelligence code. This a major breach in U.S. intelligence gathering. What do you think is going on with this whole story around Ahmed Chalabi?
First of all, as far as that charge goes, I certainly would not speculate on that either. I think we have to let this investigation play out. That is a very, very serious allegation. That could have cost American lives. That is an intelligence compromise of the greatest order.
Are you saying you're not persuaded it actually happened?
I don't know. And I think you've got to wait for these things to play out in the investigations to follow through. My issue leading up to this is I thought the exiles were painting us an overly rosy picture. We would be welcome with open arms. They were not credibly accepted by the Iraqi people and other leaders in the region. We were trying to beam them in as our people, and I think they were selling us a bill of goods on the leadership ability that they would present and their own acceptability. I also believe that in many cases, the intelligence information they were giving us going back a number of years was not accurate. Now, what the motivation for that is and how much of that might have been intentional misleading or just sources that weren't very credible, there's something else that has to be sorted out in these inquiries and investigations as we go down the road. But certainly, if they were the base for this WMD proposition that required us to launch the war so quickly, that needs to be aired out, and we need to know who's responsible for that. Because there were people in the intelligence community that wouldn't accept them as reliable sources. So why did some do it?
You're pretty savvy about how all this works. When you see U.S. troops and Iraqi troops busting into Chalabi's headquarters in Baghdad, when you see him charged with this very serious breach of intelligence security, do you see Washington infighting going on here? Is this revenge taking by one kind of sponsoring agency against another?
Well, I find it hard to believe that's a manifestation of some sort of Washington infighting out there. I would find it hard to believe that action wasn't based on something, some intelligence or some indication that there was a violation. But again, you know, we're a country of due process and justice. I don't accuse anybody of anything. Let the investigations pan out and lead where they may. Let's be open and honest about it and make sure it comes out. I think we owe that to our own need for security and to answer to the American people why this all happened.
Anthony Zinni, let's look over the border from Iraq for a second into Saudi Arabia. It's been a very disturbing drumbeat of news out of there recently. Lots of attacks, terrorist attacks, I guess you'd have to call them. Foreigners held hostage, foreigners killed, Saudis killed, and killing in return. Concern in world oil markets about the very security of the flow of oil from this largest producer and supplier in the world. What do you make of what's going on in Saudi Arabia? Is Al-Qaeda willy-nilly threatening the very stability of that country?
I think all along the main objective of al-Qaeda was to overthrow much of the leadership in the Islamic world and to replace it with a very fundamental, radical theology or theological form of governance. For a long time, Osama bin Laden has been very upfront about wanting to overthrow the royal family and to move us out and everybody else and to gain control of the country and move it back to the 14th century in some sense. I think what we see here now is, by the Saudis' own admission, they are suddenly coming to the realization that they're as much threatened as we are, actually more so than we are, and the need for them to crack down and to get to the base of this. No longer can they ignore it. No longer can they hope it goes away or try to find some sort of way of dealing with this or even accommodating it some way. But I think every country in that region has come to this conclusion. With the exception of Iran, there's probably no country out there in the Islamic world that the likes of Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda jihadis don't want to overthrow and change and move toward a direction that would be dangerous for the world and certainly dysfunctional for the people in that region of the world.
Has the war in Iraq aggravated the situation, made it worse, or has it made it better? President Bush says this is the central arena in the global war on terrorism. So has it made things better or worse in terms of the struggle with al-Qaeda?
I think it's made it worse in many ways. We've opened up a battlefield that wasn't opened up, and it's distracted us from other component parts of this war on terrorism. It has given the al-Qaeda and jihadis an additional place to attack us. It has drawn us off. It's distracted us. It's now put a strain on our military. It has damaged our relationships in that part of the world and our ability to cooperate and work against this evil extremism that's plaguing this region and the world. You know, now that we've opened this up, we have no choice but to see this through and make sure that Iraq turns out to be a positive, stable country in the region. But it is going to certainly in the short term make it much harder, and it's created an additional problem for all of us in the region.
Do you see room for a dramatic difference in approach between a Democrat and Republican presidency? There's an election clearly coming up in November. President Bush, or likely John Kerry, would be the next president. How much room for differentiation is there? How much differentiation do you see in the policies that they're promoting?
Right now, I think strategically the objectives are going to be the same. I don't see how else they could be. We're going to see ourselves committed to try to confront and deal with the extremism, the terrorism that we face, and to defeat it, to try to work with countries in the region and allies around the rest of the world to develop a global strategy, a cooperative strategy, collective strategy to deal with this. I think you're going to see maybe more differences in style as opposed to strategic objectives, maybe different approaches into how we internationalize the problem, how we work with allies, more so than whether you see the basic strategic objectives or goals differing in any way.
John Kerry puts a lot of emphasis on working more with allies, cooperating with allies. How much room is there to increase, realistically, that cooperation, that internationalization?
President Bush, 41, set a model in the first Gulf War by patiently going to the UN and getting a resolution, and then underneath the authority of that resolution, building a wonderful coalition made up of an extraordinary group of countries to confront Saddam Hussein. That model was used again and again in places like Somalia and Bosnia and East Timor, Haiti, etc. We sort of walked away from this in the case of Iraq. We've got to get back to this because it not only brings more people to the scene to help share the burden, it brings this strong sense of international legitimacy. It takes away from charges that we're trying to foist our own programs on these people and our own policies. That also helps us deal with problems where we don't have great interest, but we want to see resolved, where others in the region or others that are willing to stand up to the problem could take the lead, and it doesn't always have to be us. We can't be the world's policemen. So I think we can't get away from this sort of cooperation and this sort of building of international capacity to deal with these problems. More emphasis has to be put on that. I think there should have been more emphasis put on it right from the end of the Cold War. We didn't do enough now through three administrations to build this kind of international capacity to deal with these problems.
But realistically, given all the water that's gone under the bridge now and the souring of relationships, and a sense in Europe that you can hear easily that it's the United States' problem, let them deal with it. Do you really think that anyone can get a big buy-in from Europe, let's say, to greater investment, even boots on the ground in Iraq?
I think it can be done because it's in their own interest. They certainly don't want to see us fail in a place like Iraq. But remember, the Europeans have taken these attacks, too. We just saw what happened in Spain recently with the train bombings and the threats to Europeans. They have large communities that come from this region of the world that could be breeding places for their own terrorism. This is not a U.S. problem, and it's not a Middle Eastern problem. It's a global problem. I don't think anybody out there doesn't recognize the threat and doesn't want to deal with it. It's a question of setting up the mechanisms and getting the agreements as to how to collectively deal with this. We've broken a lot of China in this area, and we've got to bring it back together. We need to get back to the attitude we had immediately following 9/11 when, you know, we had comments in the French press that said, today we are all Americans. Yeah. And there was this sense of cooperation and a collective approach to this threat. And it's going to take some amount of diplomacy and some give and take to build this kind of global approach. The bad guys have got to be pleased with the fact that we're fighting with each other and bickering over how to go about this. This only helps their cause. And, you know, if we don't get it together and work together, we're going to individually suffer this and not get the synergy of working together to counter this evil.
Overall, since 9/11/2001, is the United States better off in its position against terrorism or not?
Well, I think there's no yes or no answer to that. There are probably many things we've done to enhance our own security that have increased our security. But there are many things since then that have not worked out to be encouraging. For example, I probably believe now that there may be more young men and women that are willing to blow themselves up or join the cause of the Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda probably as an organization we have damaged greatly, but as an ideology or philosophy has probably grown. And unless you solve the problems that drive people toward willing to sacrifice themselves for something like Al-Qaeda, you're going to continue to face this for a long period of time. The roots of this are probably some sort of economic, political, or social injustice as perceived or real that makes them feel it's better to die than it is to live under those conditions. Don't get me wrong. This isn't our fault. And in many ways, you know, maybe policies and other things exacerbated the problem. But there's regions of the world that need major reform. There are failed or incapable states that have to be brought into the community and nations and become viable states. This is a world problem again. It's a global problem. It's sort of like, you know, at the end of the last sets of world wars we went through in the last century. At the end of the First World War, we didn't win the peace. We won the war and we had a horrible peace and we were doomed to repeat it. At the end of the Second World War, you know, through the Marshall Plan, through the creation of NATO, we changed the conditions in a region of the world that caused these chronic wars in Europe and in the Far East. And we're going to have to look at this part of the world as needing this kind of attention and this kind of strategic thinking.
General Zinni, stand by. We're talking tonight with General Anthony Zinni, retired 4-star general in the U.S. Marine Corps. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with General Anthony Zinni, former commander-in-chief of United States Central Command. He's been talking and writing a lot about Iraq and the U.S. position in the world. His new book, co-written with Tom Clancy and Tony Kultz, is Battle Ready. General Zinni, just before the break, you were saying we need major reform in the Middle East. This, of course, has been the call of the neoconservatives in Washington. They've said, we've got to go in here and change this entire region, and Iraq is the place to start, and we will roll democracy in a new way right across the region. But you've been very critical of that group. Are you on the same page in some dimension or not here?
I think we would all like to see the same outcome, but I would argue with the, quote, we've got to go in and change. I think there's certain things we can do. There's certain pressures and incentives we can provide. But this has to be a cooperative, collective effort. The change has to come basically from within. There are countries out there that are beginning a process of reform. Some of it is agonizingly slow. Some of it has been remarkably progressive. Some of the small Gulf states have created parliaments, have given women the right to not only vote but to run for office, that have made some social changes, that have allowed minority groups now to be part of the system of determining their own governance. We created a remarkable change in Afghanistan by removing the Taliban, but are we allowing it to move forward? Does President Karzai have enough resources to ensure warlordism and fundamentalism doesn't return? It's pop right back to the top in poppy production, and the warlords control the areas outside of Kabul. But I want to go back to my point. This is a cooperative effort. We can't go around the world imposing Jeffersonian democracy and free market economies. I mean, we don't have the resources, nor I think the will to do that, nor should it be our role. This is an international problem. And in many cases, we can help them help themselves. But if we don't do it collectively, we're going to run into a problem and that it won't be accepted. It'll be seen as a new form of colonialism.
Let me ask you then, is the neoconservative, the neocon dream dead? The dream of Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith and Defense Policy Board member Richard Perle and others, have events proven that it's the wrong way to go? Is it dead? Or if Iraq begins to turn around a little bit, is it still alive and kicking and ready for the next frontier?
I don't think the objectives are dead. I mean, I think the objectives are what everybody wants to see. A stable, viable world where people are able to self-determine their own governance and have the kind of economy and sense of well-being that make them productive. The real issue has been the means. Where we have threats that threaten us, I believe we have to take action. But we better be sure that we have those threats, and no one's going to question that. It is preferable to deal with them collectively. But, you know, in parts of the world where we see the need for change, we need to try to do this in, again, this collective and cooperative way. This idea that we go around the world pushing our weight around is what I object to. In the end, it backfires on us. We have wasted a year in Iraq in our run occupation. I think by anybody's measure, that has not been very successful. We enter a new phase now on the 30th of June, where Iraqis will determine their future. Obviously, we're still going to have to take charge of the security piece for a while. But this is the way it needs to work. We need to see Iraqis get through to the point where they create this kind of stability. They'll need our help. They'll need our support, our advice, our resources. In many cases, we may have to bring pressure on them to help them through the right decisions. But in my mind, this is the path that I think is most effective, especially in this part of the world.
A lot of attention to the 60th anniversary of D-Day. Of course, American troops are still in Europe and Japan. How long do you think American troops will be in Iraq, Anthony Zinni?
I think if the Iraqi interim governing organization that's been created now can effectively pull off these elections come January or whenever they come about, if they dedicate themselves to viable real elections and we get a stable government and the economy begins to move and the infrastructure begins to repair, I think then the only issue is how long it will take for us to put Iraqi security forces that are well-trained, well-motivated on the streets to handle the threat. If you ask me to give you a guess, I think a year or two we can begin putting these viable forces on the ground and begin removing our forces, and probably even a little before that as we field these units. We have assigned one of our finest general officers, Army General David Petraeus, who commanded the 101st Air Assault Division there during the war, as in charge of training these Iraqi security forces, the military, these border security, the police. Could not ask for a better man. We should give him all the resources, all the support, ask our allies to help us in this area. This is not a boots in the ground issue. And that's going to be the key for us leaving and turning this over. But again, the right decisions have to be made by the Iraqis themselves on the political side now that they're going to be in charge. And as the president said, we're giving them full sovereignty.
And what does it mean, leaving and turning it over? A big base is still in Germany and Japan. Should there be long-term, significant U.S. forces in bases in Iraq, near those oil fields in the middle of this region?
I think that we will rethink how we are positioned around the world. There are creative ways that you can have a presence but not make it imposing or so visible that it's objected to. We do it with pre-positioned equipment. We do it by just coming out periodically and exercising with local forces, allies. We do it with rotational forces where we may bring them in temporarily. with the kinds of forces that are what we say are over the horizon, like naval forces, carrier battle groups, amphibious units. There are many ways to ensure your security interests are protected. There are many ways to do it so it is seen as cooperative with the regional security forces. There are many ways we can support and enhance those forces in handling their own problems. And there are many ways we can have a presence that isn't overbearing or highly visible, but yet positions us well if we need to take any kind of action.
Should that mean bases inside Iraq?
Probably not. I don't think it necessarily means bases anywhere as such. There might be bases that belong to the local military organizations that we from time to time come in and do joint exercises or operate from. But I think the old idea that we create an American infrastructure of bases like we did in Europe and the Far East after World War II and to get us through the Cold War, I think we're going to minimize that to a great extent. I don't think anybody wants that kind of investment or that kind of pressure on our military and all that means in terms of commitments and overseas presence that becomes sensitive in a political sense. There are much more creative ways we can handle this and still meet our security obligations.
Anthony Zinni, what's your level of pessimism, optimism? Can this thing be pulled out of the fire?
I have a great deal of optimism for several reasons. One, I don't see that what the bad guys are peddling, some form of extremist theocracy that probably would take the region back to the 14th century, I don't see that the young people in this region in the long term are going to buy into that. The world has changed. There's too much flow of information, and that's a failure going in. We're fighting an ideology that may in the short term may have appeal, but in the long term is a loser. I also believe the vast majority of people I know in this region desperately want to find a way out of this, want to counter this. There's a realization out there now that we should have dealt with this more firmly before, certainly on their part, and that's hitting home now. So I'm an optimist. I think if we handle this right, if we work together, if we think strategically, if we deal with these problems up front, if we try to not get into cultural wars and disagreements, we can get through this.
Anthony Zinni, retired four-star general, U.S. Marine Corps, former commander-in-chief of United States Central Command, co-author with Tom Clancy of the new book Battle Ready. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, a woman finds the journal her father kept of the D-Day invasion. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Bush was among the world leaders marking yesterday's 60th anniversary observances of D-Day, the Allied invasion of Normandy, considered the turning point of World War II. One of the 150,000 Allied soldiers who landed on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day was 21-year-old Corporal Frank T. Bindis, the father of On Point contributor Sue Diaz. Sue recently came across the journal her dad kept of the D-Day invasion. She remembers her father as a simple, quiet man. But in this radio diary, Sue Diaz says his wartime journal gave her an entirely new insight into her father.
Not long ago, my older sister mentioned our dad's D-Day diary offhandedly in a long-distance call. Well, wait a minute, I said. Dad kept a diary when he was in the war? Yeah, one of those government-issue things, she said, small enough to fit in a back pocket. And he actually wrote in it? I remember my father as a doer, not a chronicler. A reader, not a writer. Essentially, a man of few words. Oh, sure, I often heard him, my mom, and their friends talking politics and Green Bay Packers as they leaned against the rec room bar he built in the basement of our home on the south side of Milwaukee. But around his three daughters, Frank T. Bindis could be almost shy. A genial foreigner in our world of Tony Home permanence, Beatles songs, and nylons hanging like Spanish moss over the bathroom shower rod. I asked my sister to send me the diary. A week later, the book arrived. I ran my fingers over its creased blue leatherette cover, opened it, and searched for this entry near the middle. June 6th, 1944. Arrived on D-Day. Invasion Day on the shores of Normandy, France, my father wrote. Was strafed by the Jerries. Stayed near the beach area for a few days and found things to be really hot. That's it. That's all my father said about what must have been the scariest, most horrific day of his life. A day that changed the course of the war and with it, the history of Western civilization. Found things to be really hot, was all that that 21-year-old corporal in the 7th Corps could bring himself to write. I continued reading, looking all the while for what I considered the real stuff of history, the whine of bombs, the heat of combat. A few of my father's diary entries touch, but only briefly, on such things. In early July, for instance, he wrote, "Spent in a foxhole, plenty of noise and one of those 4th of Julys I hope I never have to spend again." On November 22nd, he noted, "Buzz bombs came over all day." But for the most part, my father's wartime diary chronicled a different kind of story, one filled with the beauty of distant hills and farmers' daughters, letters and cookies from home, the news that the Browns beat the Cards 2-0 in the first game of the World Series, the joy of the liberated Belgian people. On September 5th, he wrote, "Shall never forget this day and the welcome we received. Rode in an open car. People came running and shouting, 'Long live America!' Getting in our car, hugging and kissing us, throwing flowers, apples, pears, plums, confetti, beer, champagne, extending their hands for us to shake. People were so happy." And then, with the formality I recognize as my father's, he said once again, "I shall never forget this day." One snowy afternoon in Belgium, my father and a friend hiked to the top of a hill for the pure pleasure of it. Took pictures when we arrived at the top, got a wonderful view of the town. Describing a few days he spent on leave in a hotel in Brussels, he noted with obvious delight the hot and cold running water and a real bed with foot-thick mattresses and clean white sheets. In early February of 1945, he received a Dear John letter from his girlfriend back home. Her name was Dolores, like my mother's, but she is not my mom. And this jilted soldier wrote, "Hope I don't have too much trouble getting over it, but somehow or other, I think we will both see things in the same light." Good thing for me they didn't. If they had, I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't have had these moments with the pages of my dad's wartime diary. I always thought of my father as a good, hard-working man, soft-spoken, private, unemotional. And I knew him as someone who loved a thick T-bone, Glenn Miller's music, and us, Mom, me, and my 2 sisters. Yet now I see, too, that beneath those neatly pressed Van Heusen shirts of his thumped the heart of a cockeyed optimist, a soldier who somehow managed to view the glass as half full, even at a time when it was, in fact, completely shattered. My father, Frank T. Bindus, a man who, like so many of his generation, was no stranger to the horrors of war, but who chose to focus instead on the things in this crazy life that are worth fighting for.
Sue Diaz is a writer and a regular contributor to On Point. She lives in San Diego, California. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How has your life been affected by events in the news, by the war in Iraq? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. And a special welcome to our New York listeners tonight on WNYC. It's great to have you with us, On Point. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Stanley Chang and Yotam Barkai. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.